coming up on Economics Explored.
Besides, as the vilest writer has his readers, so the greatest liar has his believers. And it often happens that if a lie be believed only for an hour, it has done its work, and there is no farther occasion for it. Falsehood flies, and the truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. The jest is over, and the tale has had its effect.
Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist based in Brisbane, Australia, and I'm a former Australian Treasury official. This is episode 109 on philosophy and truth. You may recall that back in episode 101, I spoke with regular guest Tim Hughes about the scientific method. We asked, how do we know what's true and why trust science? These are important questions in these times, with big debates about how to respond to the pandemic and to climate change in particular. Tim and I return to our conversation on truth in this episode, and I'm delighted to say that we're joined by a philosopher to help us better understand the philosophical issues involved. In this conversation, Tim and I were joined by Dr. John Atkins, Honorary Research Fellow in the School of Historical and Philosophical Inquiry at the University of Queensland. Please check out the show notes for links to materials mentioned in this episode and also for any clarifications of points made in the episode. You can find the show notes in your podcasting app and also at the website economicsexplored.com. One thing I should note up front, because it's crucial to the conversation, is a quote I mangled from George Berkeley, the renowned 18th century Anglo-Irish bishop and philosopher. The correct quote is, "If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound?" Luckily, both John and Tim realised what I was talking about when I abbreviated the quote, so the conversation proceeded reasonably smoothly. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions relating to this episode or to previous episodes, then please send them to contact@economicsexplored.com. I'd love to hear from you. Righto, now for the conversation on philosophy and truth. As always, thanks to my audio engineer, Josh Krotz, for his assistance in producing the episode. I hope you enjoy it. John Atkins, Honorary Fellow in the University of Queensland School of History and Philosophical Inquiry. Welcome to the program.
Hello, pleased to be here.
Excellent. It's good to have you on the show, John. So Tim's joining me as well. Tim, Business Development Manager at Adept Economics. Good to have you back on the show too.
Good to be here, Gene.
Excellent. Excellent. So Tim, we had a conversation a few weeks ago on the truth and how do we know what's true. Yeah. And we foreshadowed that we would follow up on this conversation because it's such a big topic. And I mean, I offered my thoughts as an economist, but I mean, I recognize that I'm an economist and I'm more used to number crunching rather than this philosophical inquiry. And so you suggested, oh, well, why don't we speak with someone who understands philosophy or who is a philosopher? And you mentioned you knew John. So I thought, fantastic, let's have a conversation with John. Now, to begin with, John, it'd be good to I'd like to ask you, because we talked about Karl Popper, and Karl Popper has this idea of falsification. There's a connection between Karl Popper and University of Queensland, which you reminded me of. Would you be able to tell us that story, please?
Oh, I think the University of Queensland might be a little touchy about this. But Karl Popper famously applied for a job as a philosopher at UQ during the war, and he was turned down, even though his references came from Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore, two of the most important philosophers of their time. Popper gave up on that and headed off to New Zealand, where he wrote two of the most important books in the philosophy of science of the 20th century. So, yeah, UQ missed out on Popper, supposedly because he wrote in German, which was interesting because he was Viennese and a Jew and he was escaping the Nazis. So their reasoning behind not giving him the job doesn't seem to be rather flawed. But yes, a famous loss for the philosophy department at UQ.
Just incredible. It's as if it would be a similar situation if the UQ Economics School had knocked back Milton Friedman from a professorship. It is that extraordinary.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so what I'd like to ask, and this might be a good place to begin, is how does a philosopher think about truth? Like, how do we know what's true? Is that a good? Is that even a good question, though?
No, that's a reasonable question. It certainly has been of an interest in philosophy since the time of the Greeks. In fact, an entire segment of philosophy is devoted to the nature of truth. Pretty much all of metaphysics is the nature of truth. And the other side of the coin, the metaphysical coin, is epistemology, the nature of knowledge. And these two questions have been a prime focus to philosophy for thousands of years, at least since Plato, but going beyond that. And Plato was incredibly interested in the nature of truth and what we could call a legitimate knowledge claim. So if somebody came back from the battle and said the Athenians had won the battle, but then they were the only eyewitness, but they told other people in Athens, how would these other people know whether Athens had really won the battle?
Yes. This is the famous question, if a tree falls in the forest, does anyone hear? Is that the same question? I mean, if there's something, I mean, if we don't observe it, does it actually happen? Is that the question?
Indeed. Barclay made that question famous. I used to use a similar example on my answering machine.
Okay.
The phone rings and nobody answers it. Has it made a sound? But for Barclay, the tree did make a sound because God heard it. So he had a simple answer to that question, one that a lot of us today couldn't use. But
actually, just before we move on from that, because it is a really interesting one that we've all heard, but I've never actually delved deeper into this, so I'd like to just put this question forward now. So, for instance, the messenger coming back about the war, you know, to the Athenians or the Romans, doesn't it then come down to a question of trust as to whether you trust the person giving you the news? You know, so whether the tree fell over in the woods, like if you didn't hear it but somebody else told you that a tree had fallen down in the woods, is this then come down to a question of trust that you might have in the source of that news?
I think there's an element of trust, and I think that epistemologically interesting terms change from truth and knowledge to questions like certainty and trust. So we may be certain that given the messenger's previous history of being a truthful storyteller, that the Athenians did indeed win the battle. So we start shifting the pivot points for our questioning away from some absolute truth and to more psychological ideas like certainty.
Yeah.
So something might become most likely as opposed to certainly. Yeah. Or it becomes a question of probability as opposed to absolute.
Yeah, so this is what the International Panel on Climate Change is trying to do in its climate change reports. It's saying that we think that it's very likely that humans are contributing to climate change. So they're not saying it's 100%, but they're saying it's, I think it's very likely, I'll check that, and they're saying this corresponds to this percentage of likelihood.
Mm.
Now, what I was telling Tim about Popper, if I remember correctly, is that Popper emphasises falsification. So we can never, we've just got theories. We can never say they're necessarily the truth, but we've got theories that survive falsification, and so we can have more confidence in them. And there are theories that we reject, and we can use statistical techniques, or we can just run experiments and reject certain hypotheses. And the ones that stand up, we have more confidence in them, but we can never really be sure that they are the truth. Is that a fair summary?
I think one of the problems for philosophy of science and for philosophers like Karl Popper was the assumption that all science operates in a similar way. There are sciences like medicine where statistics are incredibly important, whereas in physics, statistics don't seem to be as important. It's things either follow our idea of the way of physical laws or they don't. We're becoming more cautious about using these statements. I mean, we note that we called it Einstein's theory, and before that we called it Newton's laws. So we've moved from laws, which are fixed in stone, to theories, which are more open to questioning. And we've got things like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle now. We've got these. We're a little more cautious about it in physics, but still we're not relying on statistics for our physical view of the world, but certainly medicine is.
It's relying on statistics. Yes, yes, yes.
Very much so.
And it's relying a lot, or it should be, on these randomized controlled trials, so that it has an experimental approach, or ideally it has. And this has been one of the problems, I think, with the pandemic, because like we've made some big policy changes on the basis of numerical modeling. We haven't really done, well, they haven't run experiments about whether particular approaches work or not. I'm thinking more about lockdowns and a lot of the control measures. And
I'm guessing with a lot of that, there's a certain precautionary principle involved. Mm. A colleague of mine back at the in the 90s at UQ, Gary Molinas, wrote a paper called Simpson's Paradox and the Wayward Professor.
Okay.
And Simpson's Paradox is a paradox in statistics, which I don't know how famous it was outside of philosophy prior to that. It's a proof of the old adage, lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yes.
It's a proof that you can take any statistical sample and divide it in such a way to provide contrary results on either side of the divide.
Mm.
And that sort of technique gets used by naysayers, and it has a political use. We see it appearing time and time again. It was used by some of the big cigarette companies when they were trying to ban cigarette advertising, etc.
Right.
Statistics is vulnerable to this sort of weakness.
Well, it's certainly vulnerable in the social sciences. So thinking about economics, I mean, we have this field called econometrics, which is essentially statistics applied to economic data. Now, the problem we have is that all the data in economics that we have violate the basic assumptions underlying classical statistics. Okay, so we have to work around that and try and adjust for the fact that everything's happening at the same time. We're trying to determine if one thing causes another, but there could be causality running the other way. There could be all sorts of confounding factors. Like a classic problem in economics is, what is the impact of the minimum wage? And economic theory, we have this beautiful, elegant mathematical theory that suggests that if you increase minimum wages, then you will decrease employment. When we go to look for that in the data, in some studies you find it, but it's generally quite a small effect. So what's going on there? Is it, what are we missing? I mean, it could be a range of things. It could be the fact that we haven't run a controlled experiment. The change in the minimum wage was not large enough to elicit any response, or the people who are deciding on minimum wages are conscious of the fact that if they increase them too much, they'll cut jobs. So you know, there's all this sort of stuff going on that makes it difficult to test economic hypotheses with data.
This tendency to think in straight lines. So
yes, yes.
Complexity is a real difficulty for any theory. In the 80s, when James Gleick came out with chaos theory, it was really interesting that he only required three variables, x, yeah. X, y, and z, and you expressed z in terms of x and y, you expressed y in terms of z and x, and so on, and that developed a chaotic situation. And some nice examples came out of chaos theory, and it's I wonder whether we will start to be able to develop it into other areas such as economics. I mean, an interesting example is an engineer will tell you, if you've got a water flowing in a pipe and there's it's of such and such a head,
yeah,
and the pipe is of such and such a diameter, that out the other end of it there'll be so much water flow. But if you ask them to specify exactly what's happening inside the pipe, the complex flow of water is indescribable, because there's a certain friction in the pipe which slows the water down on the where it's touching the pipe, and in the center where there's less friction, it's flowing much faster, and then that sets up eddy currents. Mm. Very complex behavior, water flowing in a pipe. Such a simple thing as water flowing down a hill is very complex behavior.
Yeah.
And we've traditionally tried to explain this using what's known as linear equations,
yes,
linear
yes.
mathematics. And so moving into nonlinear or dynamic ways of looking at our data is a process that we're only just starting to come to terms with.
Oh, absolutely. And look, I think the experience of economists is that some economists in, I think in the 50s and 60s, people like Lawrence Klein at University of Pennsylvania, they were trying to build these huge macroeconometric models of the economy with hundreds of equations and specifying each sector precisely and trying to estimate these equations. And then they found out that they didn't really have any forecasting ability. The models were pretty useless. It was a great disappointment. But it's because of that underlying complexity in the economy, and I guess the in the climate too, and that's why there is a lot of debate about climate change and the models.
Getting the measurements.
Yeah.
I remember reading a Scientific American article, it must be nearly 40 years ago now, where they were starting to map the atmosphere in 1 kilometre cubes.
Mm.
And just crunching the data on the atmosphere in 1 kilometre cubes is a massive,
yes,
massive task. And it involved using a Cray supercomputer back in those days. And that didn't even touch the dynamic behaviour of the oceans. Getting the information out, getting the information is into some sort of model has proved a very complex exercise. Yes.
Oh, it's an incredibly complex, and the amount of data that you need, or data that's now available. What's really impressive is I've only learned this because I've recently done an assignment on it for one of the NCRIS facilities, the IMOS organisation, Integrated Marine Observing System organization. They're based in Hobart, and what they do is that part of their work is they have these Argo floats that float around in the ocean, and then they dive down to the ocean I think every ninth day or something, and then collect all the data and then come back up to the surface and transmit it up to a satellite, and then they collect all this information on temperature and salinity and all of that. It's remarkably impressive, but yeah, it's generating a huge amount of data. And then that all has to be crunched in models, and I hope that we are getting better at it, and I hope we will get some good results out of that. It is very challenging, though. I mean, I know as an economist just how challenging it is to try and forecast the economy and understand that. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think it's a worthwhile endeavor. It's just that it can be a frustrating one at the same time.
I think human beings tend to be very poor with the exponential function. We don't have much. If I say to you that Hitler murdered 3 million Jews, and I say to you Hitler murdered 6 million Jews, we don't react in a terribly different way to 3 or 6 million. But what we're doing with the planet, you've got me onto one of my topics there, but what we're doing to the planet is absolutely mind-boggling. We could see, or enough people saw, the effects of the first nuclear bombs to be terrified by them.
Yes.
Well, we've all seen photos of them. We are releasing into our atmosphere at the moment the equivalent of 3 Hiroshima bombs every second. 3 Hiroshima bombs every second. So while I've been talking, that's probably 18 or 20 Hiroshima bombs have been put into our system.
Right.
The amount of heat, we've had to come up with new terms for that amount of, for the number of joules of heat that we're actually creating and pumping into our system.
This is just from pollution, just from our day-to-day living?
Yeah, just our day-to-day activities. It's absolutely terrifying. But we can't see it. It's we're spread all over the planet, and we're doing it in small amounts. I'm guessing that with COVID, there's probably been a little bit of a wind back, just as there was with, say, the Icelandic volcano with the unpronounceable name that stopped all the air traffic over Europe. There was a rough cutback of air traffic that was parallel the amount of sulfur and greenhouse gases that were emitted by the earthquake, by the volcano. But yeah, some pretty scary numbers. As I said, we're having to come up with new systems of calculating the size and scope of what human beings are doing.
Right. I'm going to have to look into that. I wasn't aware of that fact. I'll have to track that down. I mean, I know we're pumping a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, about 51 billion tons of it per annum. So CO2 or equivalent greenhouse gas. Mm. Greenhouse gases, but I wasn't aware of
the amount of heat, the amount of energy we're pumping in. Yeah, I'll dig out the reference on that. was only reading it last year, so it's fairly recent numbers.
That's extraordinary.
So if I'm going to jump in here and just sort of like use that climate change, for instance, as an example. So and we were talking about this whole, the subjects of what we're talking about is so enormous. We could have a million podcasts and still not necessarily come to a logical conclusion as such. But in the terms of how we initially started this, and it's fascinating, like I could sit here and listen to you guys for days. But to bring that back to what we were talking about what is true and what's not true, or on the balance of evidence, you know, what is the most likely thing to be true? Climate change is a massive one, obviously, right now. And people, it's either for or against, you know, choose the red team or the blue team, all this kind of thing. And I guess one of the, you know, because like saying with stats, they can be put over in any sort of different way, you know, for or against from the same set of stats or etc. Is there anything we can learn from philosophy that might make us better at this? Like, I know the Socratic method was mentioned, and one of the questions for you, John, was going to be, what is the Socratic method? And can that help in having better discussions or debates around something like climate change?
Well, the Socratic method gets its first outing in Plato's book, The Meno, where Meno, the slave boy, gets taught all the principles of Pythagorean geometry without actually being taught anything, just by the appropriate questions being asked. And to anybody who's seen that in action or even read the, it's only a short little dialogue, 30 pages and it's done, it can't help but be impressed. And for Plato, the significance was that he believed that in what was known as the recollection thesis, where the fact that Meno could be taught all these principles showed that he actually knew them already and all he did was recollect them. But I think we don't need to go into some sort of complex theory about it. Once that process is actually witnessed in action, it can be quite inspiring, and it certainly works well at the tertiary level, or in particular teaching philosophy students. Anybody that's had much to do with adolescent scholars or university students, undergraduates, will know that being told what's the facts or the truth, I'll put that in scare quotes, is not really a great way to relate to an undergraduate. But getting to think about the truth or getting to think about the facts is much more likely to have a positive effect. So I've spent my philosophical teaching life trying to put that into action. So it's not a bunch of facts that I teach. It's a way of looking at the world. It's more like learning a musical instrument learning to express yourself using a musical instrument, I think, than a set of data.
Right.
So you use the Socratic method as a teaching tool rather than teaching students the Socratic method as such.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yep. Okay.
Although anybody who's tried to teach students using the Socratic method realises that Plato had the benefit of scripting the replies.
Right. So does it work, like, as a tool?
If you're patient and you put in the effort, yes, I think so.
Tim, it's survived over 2,000 years, so I think it's worked.
However, it's interesting. I hadn't heard about it in my little path through life, my little sheltered path through life. So I'm fascinated by it because it came up, first of all, when we were talking about, you know, there seems to be a process, for instance, a scientific process in, you know, putting up a hypothesis, testing it, trying to break it. And if it stands up, then it's not necessarily true, but it's the best yet, which is that's a good way of going around about business as a scientist, it seems, you know, like put it up there, see if it can be knocked over. If it's still there, when everyone's throwing stuff at it, then it's not too bad as a hypothesis. And do we have anything that might be similar for being better humans and, you know, working out what's true or what's not, or being better at debate? And Socratic method came up in that. Would that be reasonable to think that that might be a useful tool for us to use as humans in better debate?
Well, obviously, being a philosopher, I think the philosophy helps. But
yeah,
I think also there's been some artificial divisions put into the way we think about intellectual inquiry. So going back to the Greeks, science and philosophy were all one. It's only been since the time of Isaac Newton that science has started to be paired off from philosophy. So
yeah.
Newton was held the first chair of what was called natural philosophy in those days. So physics was natural philosophy. And the reason why it was paired off was because physics had a set of principles now which weren't open to philosophical debate, Newton's laws, so to speak.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And a little while later, Boyle and Lavoisier branched chemistry off and so on. But really these are still philosophical topics. It's just that everything's become all of intellectual activity has become so complex that no single human being can possibly juggle all the different ideas and crucial information. So in a sense, philosophers have moved from to being generalists, I guess. We take bits and pieces of the information from all the other disciplines and try to stand astride them all and come up with some sort of reasoned view.
Yeah. Newton was really at that transition point. I think it's great that you brought up Newton as an example. I think Keynes referred to Newton because Keynes was at Cambridge and ended up in possession of a lot of Isaac Newton's old papers. And I think he called him the first of the scientists but the last of the magicians because Newton was into alchemy.
So. Yes, indeed. There was all sorts of stuff in there in Principia. Yeah,
yeah, extraordinary. And just back to the Greeks, and you mentioned how there wasn't that distinction, and that's true because Aristotle was writing about philosophy and the natural world and I guess how societies function. It's quite extraordinary.
He was trying to get some rigor into our observations, you know. How many of them are there? How big are they? How much do they weigh? How fast are they moving? That sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask, the Socratic method, is it easy to explain what it is and how it works? I imagine it's quite complex, but is there an example of it, for instance, or can we?
Oh, well, the best example of it is in Plato's Meno.
Yeah.
It's a 30-page book. But, I mean, if I can attempt a short answer, it's by not teaching facts – by not teaching things as this is the way things are, but instead asking the right questions.
Can we try it? Like, so if we do an example now, like say climate change, say I'll just play the devil's advocate here and say there's no climate change, you know, it's all false, you know, so I'm just going to be that dude.
Okay, so and what makes you think that?
Well, the data I've seen presented just doesn't seem to stack up. This is a natural cycle that happens all the time.
And where does this data come from?
I've got trusted sources.
Trusted sources?
Yeah.
Are they recognised sources?
I recognise them.
Okay. That makes it difficult.
I mean, this is the thing. Like, so this then comes back to trusted sources and...
Are they sources in refereed scientific journals?
Probably not. I mean, no. This is the thing, like I'm going against what I actually personally believe. But it is that thing, so it's just that questioning.
Yeah.
And so putting the onus back on the person to stump up with the details of how they formed their opinion, I guess, is that right?
Yeah, and these days as well, given the change in our institutions, one of the first questions anybody should be asking is where is the funding coming from?
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. So you've got to think about, are they genuinely independent or could they be swayed by financial incentives? So that's a very good point. This is a point that Naomi Oreskes makes in that book, Why Trust Science. She's a professor of the history of science at Harvard. I don't know if you've come across her work. She's very good. So like she says, what's great about science is that it's a framework, it's almost a state of mind or it's an approach and it's skepticism. She was emphasising the benefits of skepticism and in a way that could be consistent with the Socratic method, couldn't it?
Skepticism is a funny word. In philosophy it's an illness, but in science it's very healthy. So it's on a sort of continuum.
Why is that an illness in philosophy?
Well, it can get to the point where philosophers can doubt absolutely everything. I was taking a trip across from Newcastle to Adelaide in the 80s or early 90s with a philosopher colleague. We were headed to the Australian Philosophy Association conference, which was in Adelaide. And this chap had just landed from America. So it was his first look at Outback Australia. We're travelling across the Barrier Highway, and once you get out past Cobar, it's 500 kilometres to Broken Hill, and it's just this massive expanse. And I come up with a question for him, having spent a lot of time in Outback Australia and knowing that there can be a few larrikins about. I said to him, what if somebody had been out overnight and switched the signs around, and instead of heading for Broken Hill, we were actually headed for Alice Springs? To an American who had no idea of and never been on the road before, that there was some possibility, which also raised the possibility that we actually may have already crossed the border and could be in another state.
Yeah.
But to push that skepticism and start, well, are we in Australia? Well, hang on, we haven't crossed any coastline. So this sort of seeming progression from right road, right state, right country looks like a normal sort of progression that we could make. But somewhere in our skepticism, we go off the end of a cliff where we end up dropping into a chaos of our own creation.
So looking for proof where it's just accepted that, well, yeah, we're in Australia. Like, yeah, how can I prove it? Yeah.
Or I haven't been to China and back this morning. You know, it's like
prove that you haven't. Yeah,
yeah. But we might have to have a look at that Meno, the book Meno, was it,
or Plato's
the
30 Meno. Pages? Yeah.
I haven't read that. I always wondered where the Socratic method came from. I thought it might have been from the Republic, but it sounds like it's from Meno.
So for instance, just to finish off on that, like, so because it's very hard to find sensible debate or good debate on any subjects really at the moment. It's very difficult. I know in Brisbane there are the Brisbane Dialogues, which is something, you know, you might like to come along to one time, and it's about having a space for respectful dialogue about something. I think decarbonisation is coming up. Is that right?
We just had the climate change one, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah.
So I thought there was something on democracy, and
it might have been. Yeah.
Yeah.
I might be getting mixed up with what we're doing, but it's that thing of having what is basically contentious areas, but having respectful debate, because it's so important to hear opposing views to the one you might hold anyway, because it is that thing with a good debate, of course, you know, with being exposed to more information, your opinion should improve to the, you know, the more information that you're exposed to, your opinion should become better.
With some of our new means of communication, like social media, we tend to gravitate to those who like what we say.
That's right. So it becomes polarizing.
Yes, indeed.
Filter bubbles.
And then you get news filtered towards what you like. So you only get fed the news that reinforces what you already think. So it doesn't really support any sort of analytical thinking or any better thinking.
So if one is only exposed to, chief cause of philosophical disease is a one-sided diet. One nourishes oneself.
Yeah.
On only one point of view. Without criticism, we don't tend to develop our thinking much at all.
And so we need to be able to take criticism well to be part of that conversation, et cetera, et cetera. So,
indeed, which is why philosophy isn't for everybody. You hit the nail on the head. We need to be able to take criticism well.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say you should be actively thinking about, well, what does the other person think? What's their point of view? And Tom Switzer, who runs the Centre for Independent Studies, he's on Radio National, he's got his own show there. What he always quotes John Stuart Mill, I think it was, who said, he who knows only his side of the argument knows only that poorly. Is that roughly
sounds
right?
Like Mill. That sounds like Mill. It's also something that an economist would, a quote that an economist would like.
yes, on the one hand this, on the other hand that.
That's the reality, I guess, though, isn't it? Because there must be something in our build-up which looks for certainty and laws. Like we think in certainty and laws, or we seek them because there's comfort in certainty.
As Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, rigidly defined areas of uncertainty and doubt.
Exactly. So in fact, it's funny because we talk about Douglas Adams a fair bit, and so long and thanks for the fish. Maybe it would be helpful if we think less in laws but more in hypotheses, you know, so more in probability rather than certainty, because for instance, climate change, I mean, like, yeah, on the balance of probability, you know, it looks like it may be this or it may be that, instead of
that's
coming
what
out
they're
with
trying
certainties
to do.
Yeah, and the same with the pandemic and vaccines. I mean, there are very few certainties around us, I guess, but if we put ourselves up with hypotheses and this is the best yet, then that's a gentler way of having a belief which is more open to being challenged or improved on.
Yeah. So one thing we should talk about there is that, and this is something, a point I always make as an economist, because ever since, I think it was Lionel Robbins who was at LSE, economists have always been careful to distinguish between positive questions and normative questions. And so, like, what I've found with the pandemic is that, like, we just automatically jump to a particular solution because, well, okay, COVID's a serious disease. Okay, I can't deny that. But then we automatically jump to, oh, yes, let's enforce these hard lockdowns to stop the spread of COVID. And it doesn't necessarily follow that that's the best course of action. Or how do you determine that? Because some people are going to suffer. Okay, sure, maybe you can argue it's for the greater good. But how do you determine what the greater good is?
Mm.
Now, this is where you have to think about, how do you weigh up the welfare of different individuals? How can you measure that? How can you measure that welfare? How can you aggregate it? These are big questions.
Mm. Well, economists beat us to it too, as well. You mentioned John Stuart Mill before, and he, of course, he was famous as a utilitarian.
Yes,
and those ideas came into ethics in philosophy from Adam Smith, who predated them by some 50 years.
Mm.
So the whole idea of utilitarian ethics is an economist construct.
Yes, yes. Jeremy Bentham too.
Yeah. And Mill's father, James Mill.
Oh, yes.
They were the famous utilitarians. But I think one of the problems for utilitarianism is, and of course we have a famous utilitarian here in Australia, Peter Singer, probably Australia's most famous living philosopher, has taken the ideas of utilitarianism and made his livelihood out of them, made himself famous using them. But utilitarianism has some very serious problems.
Yes.
And we can't spend our days sitting down working out some utilitarian calculus on every action that we go through. It would be unduly onerous for us to have, you know, there's surely more to our lives than working out how our actions, every action that we do is, whether it's appropriate or not. We just don't have that amount of time.
Yes.
And we have a whole lot of social conventions that we tend to fall back on. So I think utilitarianism has its weaknesses, but do I have a replacement? Probably not.
Does that go hand in hand with democracy as well? Because clearly there's more utilitarian action in a democracy than there would be in a dictatorship, I guess.
Well, you know, it's the chief tool of the welfare state.
Yeah. The idea is that you promote the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Now, that's from Jeremy Bentham. The question is, how do you determine what the greatest good is? And I think there's a big debate now, or there should be, and this is what people like G.G. Foster are arguing, that we haven't done that. We've tried to, well, certainly we're in Australia, we've reduced COVID fatalities. There's no doubt about that. It's come at a cost, though, to particular groups, individuals in society.
Health, obviously, with the
mental
people dying from the disease or being impacted by the disease, but yes, then the ongoing mental health challenges from extended lockdowns, etc. So it's clearly not straightforward. That's, I think, one of the issues with that. It's clearly not a straightforward thing. So it helps to look at things in forms of hypotheses or the best yet. And it's understandable that there's going to be some lively debate around all of this because it's so the measures are so extreme.
I think the Treasurer has dropped the ball when it comes to looking after people that have fallen through the cracks.
Yeah.
When it comes to COVID lockdowns and being put out of work, and also students that have fallen through the cracks that are stuck here in Australia with no revenue.
It's certainly impacted certain parts of the society way more than others.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they had an idea, oh, this will only last 6 months. We'll provide enough support for 6 months and then we'll open up again and the economy will recover.
But that's the problem, worked, hasn't it?
It didn't exactly.
Well, if the vaccination program had been taken more seriously, then
it's not a race.
We might have been
Yeah. So we've had some issues here in Australia, and we're still in the middle of it. Hopefully everything will work out for the best in the end, but at the moment it's pretty bad.
But it's that thing as well. I mean, you know, going back to questioning, you know, like it's understandable and reasonable that people should question, should they have the vaccine? Is it the right thing, et cetera? And then it becomes a weighing up the balance of probabilities as to whether it's the right thing to do or not. And it's understandable that people have struggled with that. You know, I've made my decision, you know, personally, I've got vaccinated. I see that's the right thing to do for me, but I understand people who might not have made that decision who are struggling with it. And then it comes back into the areas of where you get your trusted source of information from, and, you know, people might doubt mine and support theirs, etc. And then it comes back into this area of trust, which I think is a big part of all of this news cycle and our forming of opinions comes down to trust and how we trust our news sources and the importance of that. You know, going back to the tree in the wood, for instance, if a friend who I trust had said, yes, I heard that tree fall down, well, I was on the balance of probability. Yeah, I think a tree would make sense because my mate Bob here said he heard it, you know, whereas, yeah. And also if no one was there that I heard it, I've actually heard a tree falling down. So I was there when another tree fell down, not that necessarily same tree, of course, but on the balance of probability, I would say that yes, if a tree fell down in the woods and no one was there, that it would have made a sound because I've had experience of a tree falling down and I heard it, you know, so it's trusting my recollection of that, you know what I mean? So trust to me appears to be the big link with all of this information around us.
Yeah, a colleague of mine has written a paper on the attitude of trust. I should dig it out for you.
Okay, well, what was the main message of it, John?
He's a philosopher, he's a Scandinavian philosopher, and he was interested in just the sort of things that Tim was talking about. So why we trust certain sources of information over others and how it seems to be easier for us to trust people who are known to us than anonymous sources or somebody that's not known to us. So, for instance, you read something in a newspaper, you find it more difficult to, particularly say the Courier Mail, you might find that more difficult to believe than if I'd been listening to you or Tim.
So the Courier Mail is our local paper here in Brisbane for anyone who's listening from outside Brisbane, and it still has a readership.
It's really it's declined a lot, and unfortunately the quality has dropped too, I think, well, because of just the loss of revenue to traditional media, and they've sacked a lot of people. It's a Murdoch masthead, and it's not the same paper it once was. I thought it was a very good paper once upon a time.
It was indeed.
Yep, and it broke the news about corruption here in Queensland back in the 80s, along with the ABC, of course. It did okay. Some good work.
I just have a quote here from Jonathan Swift, 1710. "Besides, as the vilest writer has his readers, so the greatest liar has his believers. And it often happens that if a lie be believed only for an hour, it has done its work, and there is no farther occasion for it. Falsehood flies, and the truth comes limping after it, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. The jest is over and the tale has had its effect." And I think
1710.
Yep, 1710. I think I doubt that Rupert Murdoch has read Jonathan Swift, but it's, for some reason I feel persuaded that Jonathan Swift had read Rupert Murdoch. must have a TARDIS involved.
It's interesting.
I feel like I'm defending the devil. Well, no, the devil's thing is advocate, but Rupert Murdoch is I think they're now he's now saying that I believe in climate change and we're going to be supporting climate action on climate change. I thought I saw that, or at least they're going to run a special in their papers in the lead up to the Glasgow summit that is talking about what needs to be done to avert climate change. So I think he's trying to pivot because he realises that he's so unpopular now around the world because of his stance.
It's very difficult to separate truth from self-interest or ambition. You know, so certainly some of the big news sources, it's again, understandable for whichever way people may trust their news sources, but you know, separating self-interest and ambition from and wealth and power from news is understandably a suspicious connection. You know, like there's so much, and this is nothing new, of course. Like going back to that 1710 quote from Jonathan Swift, and then further back to the Stoics, who talk about all of this stuff. back in, you know, 2,000 years ago. Like, it's nothing new that we're facing with. How do we work out what's true? How do we work out that the news from the war front is true or not? I mean, it's nothing, you know, for people who lived then, they might think it should be easier for us now with all the technology. And of course, the technology has found a way to work against us to make it confusing as well, and misinformation and disinformation. It's always been there. So we need a moral compass, I guess, of some sort to guide us through the falsehoods and, you know, the self-interest and whatever else might be trying to influence our opinions.
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite – there's been a push for some decades now from the Australian government to force all undergraduates to have at least one course in critical reasoning in all university degrees. I personally think it should happen before they get to university, high school. But critical reasoning is absolutely pivotal to a functioning democracy. We need people who are capable of thinking through a problem in order to exercise their franchise appropriately. Otherwise, people like Murdoch have undue influence in our voting patterns.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was at high school, maybe the standards dropped a bit, but we were taught that you should explore all the different points of view, or like the arguments for or against. So I seem to remember they did try to drill that into us, that we should be open-minded and weigh up the evidence on both sides and then draw a conclusion, or if there's no conclusion, just say, well, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's still uncertain. You know, further work needs to be done. Mm. That would be.
I mean, here's the sort of example I'm thinking of. I used to listen to John Laws religiously every morning, so that I would have nice current examples for my logic classes.
Okay. Do you mean examples of illogic?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Okay. And here's a classic one that I still sticks in my head now, even though he's been retired for some years now. He said, "Oh, a recent NRMA report has shown that fleet vehicles 20% more likely to have an accident than non-fleet vehicles, supporting my view that private ownership has always been a good thing." So basically, he's saying that fleet cars have more accidents. Personally owned cars, people who own their own vehicle are more likely to look after them.
Yes.
Private ownership's a good thing. And, of course, that is known in philosophy as a non sequitur, quite literally means does not follow. There could be any number of reasons why fleet cars have more accidents. They might do more kilometres than privately owned cars. They might be on the road at certain times of day when they're more likely to have an accident. There's a whole range of reasons that where – the premises he start with don't deliver the conclusion that he came up with.
Sure.
So that sort of critical reasoning is what's – now, people believe John Laws. When they hear him make an argument like that, they immediately – if they are of that political persuasion, they will be very quickly persuaded by his argument. They won't see the non sequitur. They'll just believe his argument.
Well, as an economist, it makes sense to me that you'd take more care with your own car than
it doesn't follow of necessity.
No, it's a hypothesis. You should test that, and there could be these other variables. I think in econometrics we call that those are the omitted variables, or there could be confounding factors.
In philosophy, we like to talk about validity and soundness.
Okay.
So here's a valid argument. If the moon is made of green cheese, then the cow will jump over it. The moon is made of green cheese, therefore the cow will jump over it. That's a valid argument.
Yes, yes.
The conclusion follows of necessity from the premises. Unfortunately, the premises aren't true, or one of them isn't. That's where soundness comes in. So for an argument, if that argument had true premises, then it would not only be valid, it would also be sound.
Mm. So with critical reasoning, is this a course in logic? Is that essentially what you're arguing for?
Yeah, it's an introduction to classical logic, shall we say.
I think a lot of
philosophy that gets done in universities these days, or logic that gets done at universities these days, starts with classical logic, a la Aristotle, and then moves to Australia, in fact, is leading the way with what's sometimes called paraconsistent or fuzzy logic. So, for instance...
that's what my washing machine has.
Oh, that's right. Yes, logic. Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's where it comes from. That's where it comes from. Yes. So this is not two-valued logic, not true or false, but it, something could be true, it, something could be false, or something could be both true and false, or neither true nor false.
So this fits in with hypotheses as opposed to certainties or laws, I guess. And
yeah, it's some of the classic, I mean, again, it goes back to the Greeks. Some of the classic logical paradoxes driving this new forms of logic that are being invented as we speak. It's a real, what's the word? Little income earner for philosophers or logicians. I'm not into that. I'm not into that stuff, but I do have colleagues who are.
Very good.
It's a really interesting point though about critical reasoning, because that's our answer to a lot of questions I think we've had originally. You know, how can we be better at these debates, at these questions that come up, you know, for us to vote on certain things or for what party, etc. And if we have a better understanding or skill of critical reasoning, you know, and to be able to ask better questions and to be better at listening, etc., you know, so what would that look? I mean, I think it's a great idea as well to bring into high schools even earlier to introduce this. And I know some schools have debating teams and everything, and I think it's possibly along those, you know, the same kind of line as developing those skills. What as adults, is there a good starting point to learn more about critical reasoning?
Oh, I think doing an introductory logic course would be a healthy thing for just about all individuals. I mean, we have to do a driving test to be allowed to drive on the road, and yet we don't seem to have to do any sort of test in order to exercise our vote.
That's a really good point. That's an excellent point.
We could do a future episode, Tim, on introduction to critical reasoning and just look at some of the lessons from logic and philosophy. I think that'd be really useful. We might have to start wrapping this up, John. One thing I wanted to bring into the conversation before we go is that I've been very moved by this concept or this idea of Ray Dalio's. So Ray Dalio is one of the legendary hedge fund managers worldwide. He's like worth billions of dollars. And his idea is that, and he instills this in the people who work at his firm, the investment fund, Bridgewater, they have to be radically open-minded because they're dealing with billions of dollars, okay, and they know that they could be biased. They want to avoid being biased and thinking the world is a certain way. So they're absorbing all different points of view, lots of different sources of information. They're trying to, like, they're not, they're approaching it very, their own thinking very skeptically. They're being radically open-minded. They accept that they could be wrong. If they're going to make an investment, they want to make sure they've done all the research. They're as certain as possible. It's an amazing approach, and they're very critical of each other. Like, they'll just tear each other apart.
it sounds you made me think of Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard. They walk a very narrow path. Kierkegaard has this example. He said, an honest religious thinker is like watching a tightrope walker. When you're sitting down in the bleachers looking up and the spotlight's on them, it looks like they're walking on nothing but air. And it struck me that he's encouraging is walking a very narrow line. Whilst you're being open-minded, it's mind-boggling, actually, what would be involved in working in under such a regime, I think.
Yeah, but he came to that position because he became famous in the as an investor and then an economic commentator in the early 80s, and I think he made a big bet, and it had to do with third world debt. And I think he probably underestimated the extent to which there'd be the Latin American debt crisis that occurred in the 80s, and he ended up losing a ton of money on it. He tells this story in his Principles. I'll put a link in the show notes and try to tell the story properly. But he ended up being incredibly embarrassed and losing a lot of money over it. And from then on, he thought, I'm not going to believe I'm the smartest person in the room, okay? Mm. I'm going to question everything, question all my assumptions, just be radically open-minded, because if you're not, you can make some bad decisions and lose a lot of money. So I thought it's a really good approach. Yeah.
And I guess at some point, though, you've got to decide to do an action, like you know, applying we spoke previously about the OODA loop that the military use, and that's their little process. I say little process, like it's an awesome process of decision-making. We got this from Paul Taylor, I think, who has got an excellent podcast here in Australia or everywhere, of course, now.
Mind, body, spirit, is it?
Mind, body, brain project.
Ah, yeah. Okay, close enough.
But Paul Taylor, so he's ex-military, fascinating guy, and he talks about the OODA loop, which if I get the two O's the right way around, it's observe, orientate, decide, and act. And so you go through that process, and once you've acted, then you go back to observe, orientate, decide, act. So it's a very cool, rational way of deciding what action to make. And I'm thinking about that, listening to what you're saying about being open-minded, which I fully agree with. At some point, because you can be so open-minded that you never act, I guess, or never decide, because you're constantly taking in new information. So at some point, I guess, you work out how much diverse information you've taken on board in as little time as possible, I guess, because he wouldn't be keen on taking too long to make a decision. But no.
They have a process.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know what that process is.
You get into analysis paralysis. I mean, you can't keep analysing forever.
Yeah, so I guess that's where the OODA loop comes in, because it's obviously very efficient and relatively quick, because in a lot of situations they wouldn't have much time to make that decision. So there'd be some sort of blending of those and with that analytical or that analysis. It'd be interesting to find out more about that if we do that.
Yeah, we should do that. I should brush up on that. I think what's important is you make a decision of some kind. If you have a deliberation, you make a decision. That decision could be, we're not going to invest in that. There's too much uncertainty. That's fine. Or it could be, we need to gather more information. Then we'll come back and make another decision at X date.
Yeah.
But the idea is, you need to have some sort of endpoint or some sort of process, and
which fits into then for the decision to be, this is the best so far. Mm. So we're acting on that. And so it's not necessarily a certainty or anything else, but information at hand and what we have time to do, and we need to make a decision, that's the best we can do at this point, and then go through that again if we were to follow the OODA loop as part of that process.
Exactly.
Okay. John, before we finish, I just wanted to ask, because you mentioned, is it, if I remember this correctly, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle?
Mm.
I'm fascinated that somebody was able to do an uncertainty principle, but be certain enough about it to put pen to paper and say that is an uncertainty principle. So is that just, is it an easy one to briefly explain? I love that somebody's got an uncertainty principle.
Oh, the uncertainty principle is
I've got several of those, but I haven't just finished them yet.
Dates from, I think,
early 20s
or 30s, where you could have a subatomic particle and if you measured its momentum, then you changed its location in the very act of measuring it. Or if you ascertained its location, you changed its momentum in ascertaining where it was. So you interfered with it.
So I guess that what makes me think of then is Michael Apted's really good documentary series, 7-Up, where he gets kids at 7 years old and they talk about themselves. It's a documentary.
Yes.
And then again at 14 up, 21 up, et cetera. And so going through, I think they're up to like 63 up now. It's fascinating to see it through those 7 year intervals. But the process of being in a documentary all your life and documented every 7 years then would possibly affect what people may or may not have done to an extent. Mm. It's still fascinating nonetheless, and I think it's been a really good social documentary to have.
But there is an effect
that could be impacted by something like that.
There is an effect in the social sciences that perhaps you could draw an analogy with Heisenberg uncertainty principle. I don't think I've ever thought of it like that, but you could be right. The Hawthorne effect, where if you observe people, then they will act differently. So if you're monitoring workers to assess their productivity, when they're being monitored, they're going to work harder, right? Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. No, thank you for that. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is my takeaway.
I'll put a link in the show notes because it's an important principle, and I think it leads to quantum physics, which raises all sorts of philosophical questions itself we won't get into.
Very much a specialty area these days.
Yes. But there's a good podcast by James Altucher on a book about, it's about the origins of quantum physics by Italian physicist Carlo Rovelli, which is very good. I'll put a link in the show notes. Okay, John, any final words?
No, it's been a pleasure discussing these matters with you. As you may have worked out, I'm not one for theories. I'm one to respond to other people's theories. But it's been a very pleasant exercise.
Very good. Yes, we've learned a lot about the Socratic method for sure. I'm going to have a read of Plato's Meno. Mm-hmm.
Meno.
Okay, very good. And we'll have to have a chat about that in the future, Tim, I'm sure.
I've loved it. Thanks, John. I really appreciate your input. Yeah. It's been fascinating. Thanks, Gene, too.
Pleasure. Thanks for your time, guys.
Cheers.
Cheerio.
Okay, that's the end of this episode of Economics Explored. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your family and friends and leave a comment or give us a rating on your podcast app. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, you can feel free to send them to contact@economicsexplored.com and we'll aim to address them in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Until next week, goodbye.